Sitting opposite me in Musselbrook is a gentleman called Michael Mobbs, a wonderfully memorable name, I would have thought, terrific for a byline. He's the author of two remarkable books, Sustainable House and now Sustainable Food. He's in Musselbrook to, as a missionary, to bring us his story and to get us all to behave ourselves. And I'm going to just read this little tiny bit from his introduction. In 2010, I saw a young fellow crouching on the road verge, gathering weeds and placing them with surprising care into a plastic container. "I'm making salad," he said. And I later discovered he was a head chef in a famous restaurant, and he lived around the corner. This road verge was in Chippendale, which is a small, closely built suburb, 4,000 residents, 4,000 workers, 40-minute walk from the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. Well, inspired by that example, Mike has been pushing the idea of using what we regard as decorative or trivial pieces of land for the purposes of nourishment. And Mike, I'm thrilled that you've come to Musselbrook, but let me start with the obvious problem. You and I are sitting in the coal capital of Australia. Mm-hmm. We are surrounded by mountains mm-hmm. of overburden shoved aside. There are little electric noses all over the district that sniff the air to alert the council and the community to problems if there's too much nastiness being blown from the mine sites. The damn things go off pretty much 24/7. Mm. And the whole of Musselbrook and most of the citizens' lungs are coated in dust. And that's the stuff you can see. I'm reliably informed that what you can't see is even worse. Why would anyone want to grow food here when the condiments are so unpleasant?
I have been speechless at the size of the mountains of waste soil piled up to make way for the coal to be removed below it. It's one thing to fly over it. It's another thing to drive by it for the first time in my life. And I'm a short man and easily impressed by things of any height. I found the drive here from Sydney up to the higher part of the Hunter Valley today a bit like a drive through a horror movie. It's a very brutal landscape. So there's a lot of things going on
here. It is now. It was once very beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, there are bits of it where that the memory of the past is there. At the same time, we have in Chippendale, we don't have lowing cattle or burbling brooks. We have sirens, needles, the can and condom littered moonscape, really. And I used to be a lawyer before I began a long journey back to rejoin the human race, and I'm driven by facts, and I didn't want to, when I made my house sustainable, kill my kids by asking them to drink rainwater. So in those days, there was no data on the quality of stored rainwater in any Australian city. Today, fast forward to our discussion about food, I didn't want to, if I had guests and I served them some food, be unable to answer the question, well, you know, is this safe to eat? So I got advice. And the same question can be applied not just to Musselbrook, or Chippendale, or Toorak, or Woollahra. When you walk down the beautifully lit aisles of the chain stores, what is that food that glows so beautifully under the carefully designed lights? I would rather the provenance of a weed that a dog may have weed on, which I've seen outside my verge in Chippendale, and for which I've stopped the council spraying. I'd rather that provenance, including anything that might be grown here, than stuff that's come from thousands of kilometres away, where the record is clear that they do stuff to it that we don't do here, and they spray stuff on it here to make it safe when they bring it in. That's a long question to a long answer to the first question, and I promise never to give such a long answer for the rest of our conversation here, but it's safe, whether it's here or not. You just have to know two things. Plants are designed to exclude lots of nasties, except pesticides, which are specifically designed to bypass those protection. And secondly, if you wash it, you get rid of the stuff that's there, just the same as you're invited to wash the stuff in chain stores. But I would buy and eat anything from Musselbrook or Chippendale or Toorak ahead of anything from China, Peru, Brazil, any day of the week.
Is there anything we could do with those mountains of overburden? Could they be usefully redeployed?
Well, I looked at them. Like, there's one that takes up the whole of the horizon from this town. I just can't imagine how many. I would say that half of that mountain would have been taken up by the oil needed to power the engines to make it so big. If we can't do something useful with that stuff now, then there's two things that have happened. The huge pollution coming out of that mine before, during and after and from burning it. And the sterilisation of that huge amount of soil. I can't answer your question, but if we can't, we're doubly betrayed by the process.
We're murdering the earth on a massive scale.
We are. And when you walk amongst the corpses that I see here in the Hutter Valley, I've been quiet several times today. It's having quite an impact on me. It's one thing to say, oh, the Hunter's full of coal mines. It's another thing to go there.
And it's another thing to live in proximity to it, or indeed smack bang in the middle.
Do you know, I discovered today, and I do watch and listen to and absorb the media, I discovered today that the New South Wales Pollution Authority tells people by text when the air is too polluted in different bits of the Hunter Valley. And while I was talking to some locals here, they got 6 text messages in about 5 minutes, not all from this part of the valley. But there's no news of this in Sydney.
And there's no community reaction to it anymore. There's a certain passivity or surrender now, an acquiescence to it.
Well,
the mines, I can't do anything about it. It's just as much a product of mining as coal.
Look, it's not a good thing to be speechless in an interview, but I'm speechless on this. Ask me another question about something else.
I want to switch from Musselbrook to Manhattan, because while we were sitting here waiting for the big hand to point at 10:05, you were thinking aloud about the images. Are the images, the experiences that are now happening in America, do they represent a tipping point? And we were discussing images which change the world. I think there was the famous double spread photograph of the Franklin River that was run as an ad, a colour ad in newspapers for such a moment. The photograph of the little girl fleeing the napalm attack. Mm. You know, there are the burning bonzes, so-called, of Vietnam. America is in massive denial, has been to this moment, on climate change.
Yeah, and this is a good discussion for us old fellas to have, because we've lived through conflicts which have taken a decade. You know, it's 10 years and more in Vietnam.
Yeah,
it was 10 years or more in the Franklin. But we clearly remember the images which were pivotal and were watershed political moments. And I've been watching this debate about climate change, and the book is an attempt to provide practical solutions to it. But I looked at those images of New York and I thought, here are white people in the centre of the most powerful nation of the world with water running down their main streets,
filling their subways,
and their trains halted, and their infernal beast, the stock exchange, halted for 2 days in a row. And I think, putting myself in the shoes and listening to some of the broadcast, this may be the moment when the heart-beating centre of America, New York, says there's a problem here, and it's called climate change. I think they'll name
which
it.
Which no one has been telling us about.
No. That's right. They'll say, how come no one told us about this? I think there's a moment of hope in those terrible scenes. I could be wrong, but for the first time watching this debate, I thought, this matters. This is a really important
well,
moment.
Well, those extraordinary images of 9/11 have never stopped resonating. And these images, equally without precedent in the American experience, except in, you know, in movies, a bit like 9/11 itself, all pre-imagined cinematically, certainly will shake them to their core. But here's Obama, who, when he was campaigning for the presidency, pre-echoed, you know, the Kevin Rudd argument, that this is the great moral and ethical challenge of our time. And yet political reality meant he backed off, and the words have never passed his lips again. It'll be interesting, if he wins, to see whether those words are uttered in the acceptance speech or in the swearing-in ceremony.
You would wonder how an intelligent man, such as he is, could go down the streets with the Republican governor, be so engaged in the human tragedy of it, and not say to himself somewhere between there and waking up a couple of times, I've got to do something about this. I'm the person that can do something with this.
Okay, let's come back to you now, back to Michael Mobbs. Sustainable House, this remarkable little house you converted, basically by working on the bathroom and the kitchen and the toilet, into a larger tourist attraction than the Opera House, by showing people how you could reduce your footprint to, well, in your case, to less than a stiletto heel.
That's right.
Now sustainable food. When I look at the books, and they're vivid, they're wonderfully illustrated, they're energetic, they're simple, I still feel that I'm looking at religious tracts rather than things that can actually change the world. Convince me that growing herbs and spices on the verges of the roads or the so-called nature strip, and nothing is more unnatural than an Australian nature strip, that these things matter? Or do they matter as symbols?
Well, I couldn't understand why people took my kitchen and bathroom seriously. When the publisher said, write a book about it, I said, who would buy that? It went through 14 reprints in the Australian market. It's an extraordinary bestseller with over 60,000 copies. So there's those numerical demonstrations of interest, but there's also the conversations I've had with the 19,000 people.
And this is the number of people who actually come to your house.
That's right, seen whether or not I've cleaned the dishes. And what strikes me, and it took me a long time to hear it, because I still didn't take it as having any significance, people would say, you changed my life, and I can do this. And it wasn't in that, guru way. It was people are afraid of whether or not a water-efficient showerhead or a solar-powered light will actually ruin their household. They're afraid of change. But I don't know why they'll take up an iPhone in a nanosecond.
Yes, we embrace technology.
Yeah.
Electronic technology,
yeah.
Very fast.
Yeah. And we don't do it with things that will sustain our culture, like water, energy, food. It's quite interesting. The reason I did the book about food is I discovered that the house was a trivial failure. Yes, it saves 100,000 litres of water a year. Yes, four people can live there for less than $300 a year for energy and water bills. Yes, anybody can buy any of the stuff anywhere in Australia, any tradesperson can put it in. But in 10 days of eating the typical Australian diet, there's over 100,000 litres of water in the food. It's my little tummy, said he, sucking it in, which uses more energy and water than the house. So I needed to get these facts when I did the fit-out for Google in their new snazzy offices. In Sydney, their 53rd employee was a chef. They had to work out how to get people to come to work and be productive. Came down to food, he bought local food. We won the job to do the fit-up by saying we would bring local farmers' food in, we'd bring local chippies. And I discovered then that Google's daily consumption of food would use far more energy and water than the building.
one step at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
The long march begins with the first step. Michael, thank you. It's delightful that you're here. I'm sorry that you found Musselbrook such a harrowing experience. But there was a sizable crowd to listen to you. And I commend to you, dear listener, Mike's book, Sustainable House, and the one sitting in front of me, Sustainable Food. If they are religious in spirit, one could be described as his Old Testament and the other as his New.
Thank you, Phil.
This is LNL on RN coming to you from the Vesuvial landscape of Musselbrook. And after a little bit of music from my dear colleague Paul Gough, we're going to be discussing the sombre topic of the Armenian genocide.